service. Blood on the Tracks is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis. John Lennon was a musical genius and one of the most beloved cultural figures of the 20th century. His songs inspired dreamers to imagine. His search for the truth gave power to the people. But some thought he dreamed too much. Others thought he was too powerful. So he was followed. He was threatened. He was declared a danger to the United States. And in 1980, he was assassinated. This is his story, told by his so-called friends.
This is Special Agent Jim Steele with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, working case number 009-08-0491. Case subject is Lennon John Winston Ono. This information pertains to a period ending December 1980. Interview subject is Chapman Mark David. Interview number 0-71-619-51. Recall number 1, December 8th, 1982.
I knew I was going to shoot him that night. I absolutely did. I tried not to. I prayed that it wouldn't happen, but deep down, I knew it would come to that. I stood in front of the mirror in my hotel room at the Sheraton and thought, look, this is me. Probably this is the real me. This is my past, and I'm going. I'm gone to another place. It was like I was going through a door. The poet's door, William Blake's door, Jim Morrison's door. I was leaving my past. I was leaving what I was and going into a future of uncertainty. There were tremendous feelings of Holden Caulfield and The Catcher in the Rye. The paragraphs and sentences of that book were flowing through my brain and entering my blood, influencing my thoughts and actions. My very soul was breathing between the pages of The Catcher in the Rye. Then, I loaded cartridges into the 5 empty slots in the cylinder of my Charter Arms 38 pistol and looked into the mirror once again. I held the pistol up in my right hand. I closed the chamber with a flick of my wrist. And I looked dead into my own eyes and said out loud, "The Catcher in the Rye of my generation, chapter 27. And I walked out the front door of the Sheraton and made my way over to the Dakota. John Lennon's songs wouldn't leave my head. All I could hear was John Lennon. I could see the songs. They were on the asphalt and in the clouds, and they tumbled down the stairways of subway stations. The songs were covered in blood. Blood all over the songs. Blood on the tracks.
John Lennon and Mark David Chapman.
Do you want to know what goes on inside my head? Do you really want to know? That's why you're here, isn't it? To dig through the depths of my mind? To determine once and for all why I did what I did? Why did Mark David Chapman shoot John Lennon in the back 4 times on the evening of December 8th, 1980? Why? Why?
All I could hear was John Lennon.
I've told the head shrinkers everything already. Told them over and over again.
Tremendous feeling.
I probably talked with a dozen of them for hundreds of hours, if not thousands. I'm serious. I'm just about sick to death of it. Like I told them, I was a nobody. Mark David Chapman was a nobody. A failure. I couldn't even hold down a job at the hospital. The same hospital in Hawaii that I was rushed to when I tried to take my own life at 22. That was just 3 years before I took someone else's life. John Lennon's life. Anyway, the hospital probably took pity on me and gave me a job in the print shop. But I failed that, just like I failed everything else. Being a nobody, being a failure, I was sick to death of that, too. Made me angry.
I prayed that it wouldn't happen.
I'd been angry for years. Mostly at other kids in school, and at my father. Abusive, neglectful. He really did a number on my mother when he left. Left us with nothing. For years, I focused my anger on him. This fantasy played out over and over again in my head. I'd track my father down, get him alone, and bring a gun with me.
I loaded cartridges into the 5 empty slots.
I'd press it to his temple, press it so hard that it would leave a mark, and I'd remind him about all the awful things he'd done to my mother, and tell him that he would pay for it. He'd pay for her pain. He'd pay for my anger.
I knew I was going to shoot him.
And then I'd ask him if he was scared. If he was scared of dying. If he was scared of going to hell. I'd say, "Well, this is it, Dad." And then I'd pull the trigger. But I never did. Never followed through. I was too weak. Too scared. I was nobody. Now, take John Lennon. John Lennon was somebody. He was a somebody. He was the leader of the Beatles. The Beatles were my favorite band.
I could see the songs.
But John Lennon squandered what he had. I'm not saying that he took it for granted. I mean that he turned his back on it. He turned his back on who he truly was. He was a phony. That's what Holden Caulfield would say. A real phony. He was a millionaire who sang Imagine No Possessions. He was a hypocrite. John Lennon sang that he didn't believe in God, didn't believe in Beatles. Who in the hell does he think he is? That's what I would ask myself. Who in the hell does John Lennon think he is to say that he's bigger than Jesus? That really rubbed me the wrong way. John Lennon had walked through a door. He left behind who he used to be and became someone different. But the person he became, the place he went to, phony. I figured I could show the world that John Lennon didn't deserve to be somebody. I could expose him for what he truly was, and in doing so, I could become somebody. I could be famous. I could get attention.
I'm going.
I didn't just come around to this on the fly all willy-nilly. I'd practiced. I was a king once. I was king of the little people. The little people were much smaller than me. They lived inside the walls. I wasn't just their king. I was their hero. My face was on the front page of the newspapers that they read. I was on the televisions that they watched. They even worshipped me. I was a god to them. I'd play them my Beatles records. But sometimes the dark clouds came. Not to the little people, to me. The dark clouds in my head.
I tried not to.
The clouds would come, and I would start to think about my father, or I'd think about the kids who beat on me on the basketball court back in high school.
I prayed that it wouldn't happen.
Or I'd think about John Lennon, the phony Beatle.
The songs were covered in blood.
I'd get angry. There was a couch in my living room. The couch had a button. I think it was to help the couch recline. But in my mind, the button was directly wired to explosives in the wall, right where the little people lived. I was the only one who had access to that button. I had the power.
But deep down, I knew it would come to that.
The clouds would gather in my head, and I would get so furious, and my thumb would press down hard on that button. My thumb would ache like it had been stung. The wall would explode. Hundreds of little people dead. Thousands of little people dead. I killed off entire families, villages.
Chapter 27.
Then I'd calm down. The clouds would break up. I'd regret what I'd done. I'd apologize to the little people, to those who had been spared. I would apologize to them, and then they would all forgive me. Their king, their hero, their god. And then everything would go back to normal. At first, I didn't want to tell anyone anything. They charged me with second-degree murder. They said I was insane.
Look, this is me.
That I wasn't fit to stand trial.
Probably this is the real me.
Fine, I thought. Let them think I'm insane. They were holding me at Rikers Island. They put me in a bulletproof vest and walked me over to court, just so my attorney could withdraw from my case. People were threatening his life, I guess. He called the trial an albatross. And people were dying. All because he had died.
John Lennon.
Some 16-year-old girl in Florida took a handful of pills. Took her own life. And then a man in Salt Lake City swallowed the barrel of a gun and pulled the trigger. People just couldn't live in a world that didn't include John Lennon, apparently. Fans were flooding Yoko Ono's mailbox with distraught letters. So many letters that she had to appear on television simply so that people all over the world wouldn't lose hope. I don't know if you'd call this hope, but it was at this time that I got the message. The message from God. I'd been waiting to hear from God for so long.
I prayed.
He told me to change my plea. I was not insane. I was a nobody who wanted to be a somebody.
This is the real me.
And if I wanted to be a somebody, I had to plead guilty. I had to show them all who I really was.
My thoughts and actions.
And so I did. I asked the judge to change my plea. The new attorney they'd given me didn't agree with that choice. He thought I was a loon and argued that I wasn't, I wasn't of sound mind or whatever they say in court. That I wasn't capable of making that decision on my own. But I won out. I convinced the judge.
I absolutely did.
That was that. There was no more trial. I was guilty. Guilty in the eyes of God, and guilty in the eyes of every Beatles fan in the world.
John Lennon's songs wouldn't leave my head.
And then I wouldn't talk to anyone about anything. Because I was angry again. I was still angry at John Lennon, and now I was angry at God for putting me in this position. I was angry at my own wife. My wife flew into New York from Hawaii. I refused to see her. She knew this was going to happen. She did nothing about it. I first came to New York in October of 1980. I came to kill John Lennon.
Blood all over the songs.
But I didn't follow through. I'd gone back home to Hawaii and told my wife all about my plan. I showed her my gun. I made her understand what I was capable of. She could have prevented the whole thing. Could have called the police. Could have had me locked up. But she didn't. So when she came to see me when I changed my plea, I refused to see her. I shaved my head, flew into a rage. I smashed a TV set and then a radio.
I could see the song.
I tore the pages out of my Bible. The thing was lousy with lies. Thought of Holden Caulfield, how he flew into a rage when his brother died and broke his hand by punching out windows in the garage. He said his hand still hurt years after. He couldn't even make a fist when it rained.
The catcher in the rye of my generation.
I stopped in the middle of my outburst. Think if anything hurt. My hand that had smashed the TV set, or my fingers that had torn so many pages from that book.
The paragraphs and sentences of that book.
I wondered if things that hurt now would still hurt years later, like Holden had said. I figured that they probably would. I took the torn pages from the Bible and stuffed them down the toilet in my cell. Tried to flush it all down, the whole crummy thing, but it wouldn't go down, and the water backed up, flooded the floor of my cell.
I tried.
A couple of prison guards came in to find out what the hell was going on, so I dipped my hands in the toilet and threw dirty Bible water at them. I ripped the clothes from my body. I screamed out loud. It took 6 guards to get me under control. Once they had me subdued, they drove me out to Bellevue, to the loony bin. This was August of 1981. And to think, just 9 months before that, on December 7th, 1980, I was sitting at the hotel bar at the Sheridan Center, 7th Avenue and 52nd Street. I was drinking a Heineken. I was thinking, of course, about John Lennon.
All I could hear.
But I was also thinking about Holden Caulfield, about how he had rented a hotel room in New York City, just like me. He was dissatisfied with people, just like me.
Look, this is me.
I thought about Holden some more, and I wondered if I could step through a door and step into Holden's shoes. I could be Holden, because I wanted to be Holden. I think I was destined to be Holden, to become him, to live out the rest of his life. I decided to start that very night. I called a prostitute up to my room, just like Holden had.
The catcher in the rye of my generation.
She came upstairs, we sat on the bed and talked. That was all. No sex. Just like Holden. I paid her. She left around 3 in the morning. I thought about how Holden had to deal with the elevator operator in the book. The guy who got him the prostitute in the first place. And how that guy then tried to extort Holden by charging him twice the rate they'd agreed upon.
Flowing through my brain and entering my blood.
He insulted Holden, attacked him. Holden wanted revenge. But all he had was fantasy. He fantasized about having a gun, about aiming it at that smarmy elevator operator, making him beg for his life, and then shooting him in the stomach 6 times. I knew that, unlike Holden, I had more than fantasy at my disposal. I knew that I could step through a door.
I'm going.
I could leave myself behind, and I could do all the things that Holden Caulfield had wanted to do but couldn't. I could be somebody. And this is how it happened.
We'll be right back after this
word.
I was standing around like a real idiot, waiting for him to come back. I didn't want to be there, but also knew that I had to be there. I wanted to step through that door.
I was leaving my past.
I had to remain right where I was, outside the Dakota, waiting for John Lennon. It was December 8th, 1980. I met him for the first time earlier in the day, late afternoon maybe, almost dinner time. I'd been hanging around the Dakota with this guy, Paul Gorish. People called him Fat Dave. He was a photographer, though I don't know who he took pictures for. People like Fat Dave hung around outside the Dakota, hoping to get a photo or a handshake or an autograph when John emerged from inside. They all thought I was one of them, another Fat Dave. But I wasn't anything like them.
I was leaving what I was.
I wasn't there to fawn over John Lennon, the phony. I wasn't there to usher my way into his life.
I could see the songs.
I was there to end his. When, at long last, John and Yoko came out that afternoon, I almost didn't say anything. I clammed up. My muscles clenched tight.
I tried not to.
Fat Dave pushed me into John's path, said I came here all the way from Hawaii. This was my chance. Like I was just like him.
I prayed that it wouldn't happen.
I was holding a copy of John and Yoko's Double Fantasy, along with a red paperback copy of The Catcher in the Rye. I asked John to sign the album. He did. He signed the album cover right on Yoko's neck. And then he looked me in the eyes. I've talked about this before, but I feel that it is important to restate. He looked me right in the eyes.
And I looked dead into my own eyes.
And said, "Is that all? Do you want anything else?" It was like he looked into my eyes and knew that I was the person who was going to take his life. That his life would end that day, that night. John and Yoko left in a limousine, and so I waited again. I told myself I would wait until they returned. I killed time talking with the doorman at the Dakota. I found out he was from Cuba, so naturally that made me think of the Bay of Pigs, and so we talked about Kennedy's assassination. A homeless man asked me for money, so I gave him 10 bucks. And for hours on end, I prayed to God.
All I could hear was John Lennon.
I prayed to God to help me find a way out.
I prayed.
God delivered to me another fan who was hanging around the Dakota, a girl named Jude. If you can believe it. I asked her out to dinner that night, thinking that she could be the reason why I didn't go through with it. She could save me. God could save me through this woman.
I knew I was going to shoot him that night.
But she turned me down. She said no. And here I thought God was going to help. So I prayed to the devil instead.
William Blake's door.
I asked the devil to give me strength to help me see through what I knew I had to do.
The poet's door.
I told the devil that I had already talked to God and that God did not answer, that God did not care. God didn't care that I was a nobody. But the devil cared. And the devil wanted me to be somebody. The devil knew who I really was, what I really was. The devil knew what I was capable of. And the devil was with me at 10:50 that evening when the limousine returned. "Do it," the devil said to me. I heard the devil as the rear passenger door of the limo opened and Yoko stepped out. John followed shortly behind, and I heard the devil again.
Flowing through my brain and entering my blood.
"Do it." Yoko walked right past me. I mumbled hello to her, but she didn't respond. John got closer to me, and the voice in my head got louder. "Do it."
Influencing my thoughts and actions.
As John walked by me, he didn't look happy. I think he registered that it was me, that I was still there all these hours later. Perhaps he thought I was just like the rest of them, some desperate fan. Perhaps he remembered the conversation we had earlier in the day when he had asked me, "Do you want anything else?"
My very soul was breathing.
Perhaps he knew that this was the something else. The thing that was about to happen.
I knew.
But he just kept walking. He walked right by towards the front gate of the Dakota. Didn't say a goddamn word. I reached in the pocket of my jacket and felt my shaking hand grab onto the handle of the Charter Arms 38. It was a snub-nosed pistol, so it was easy to conceal, easy to hold, easy to aim.
I held the pistol up.
I didn't know if the bullets would even work. I'd never shot a gun at a person before. My hand wouldn't stop shaking as I pulled the 38 out into the cold December air. "Do it," I heard in my head. "Do it, do it."
Chapter 27.
I aimed right at his back and I pulled the trigger twice.
Blood all over the songs.
Both shots hit John in the back. The devil got louder. "Do it." John turned around and stumbled. I thought of Holden's fantasy with the elevator operator. I was the gangster that Holden wanted so desperately to be. I'd play it out for him.
I was going through a door.
I fired three more times. Two of the shots caught him in the shoulder. The third missed. I heard glass shatter.
They were on the asphalt and in the clouds.
And then everything went blurry for a few seconds. It was like the film strip broke. I didn't know if I'd made it through the door or not, but I felt different than I had ever felt before. I stood there on the sidewalk. My arm was hanging at my side. I was holding on to the 38. The doorman, who I had spoken with earlier, ran up to me and knocked the gun from my hand. Things got clearer then. I felt the air pinch my face. I couldn't see John anywhere.
John Lennon's songs wouldn't leave my head.
I later learned that he had been able to make his way up the stairs towards the Dakota, where he collapsed. I waited for more instruction, to hear the voice of the devil once more. But the devil was gone. No devil, no God. I was alone. I wanted to walk through that door.
The paragraphs and sentences of that book were flowing through my brain and entering my blood.
I wanted to live out the life that Holden Caulfield had left behind.
My generation.
I began to pace. I paced back and forth in front of the Dakota. I didn't know what to do with myself, so I pulled the paperback copy of The Catcher in the Rye from my back pocket and started to reread.
Chapter 27.
And as I waited for the police to arrive, and for the ambulance to arrive, I wondered what everyone would think of me now. I wondered if they would all look at me and see a somebody.
Tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon, outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous perhaps of all of the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. Hard to go back to the game after that news flash, which in duty bound we had to take. Frank.
Indeed it is. NYPD officers Peter Cullen and Steve Spiro were the first to arrive at the scene. The Dakota, 72nd Street in Central Park West, December 8, 1980. There had been reports of loud noises, five bangs in quick succession, gunshots maybe. Cullen and Spiro thought the more likely explanation was fireworks. It was the Chinese New Year, and even at 11 o'clock at night, in the city that never slept, someone was always out celebrating something. But there was no celebration at the Dakota, no fireworks. When Cullen and Spiro pulled up in their police cruiser, they unknowingly walked into an unforgettable tragedy. The Dakota, its late 19th century Gothic spires, turrets, and gargoyles cast an eerie pall. Cullen and Spiro could feel the building's hulking gray frame looking down on them and on the small but gathering crowd, and on two men in particular. One standing still on the sidewalk in an overcoat, his hands raised over his head, a red paperback clenched between his fingers. The other on the floor of the Dakota's vestibule, bleeding from his mouth and chest. Cullen was surprised to find that the man still had a pulse. He was even more surprised as he searched for a face behind the blood-stained eyeglasses that he realized exactly who the man was. New York's most famous resident, one of America's best-loved adopted sons. Cullen couldn't believe it. John Lennon was dying right there, fast. Meanwhile, Spiro tended to the man in the overcoat with the red paperback above his head. The Dakota's doorman, Jose Perdomo, made the man, Mark David Chapman, as the one who fired the fatal shots. Spiro pushed Chapman up against the wall of the Dakota, read him his rights, cuffed him. John Lennon was bleeding out in front of Cullen's eyes. Cullen radioed dispatch for an ambulance. 10 minutes out. They didn't have 10 minutes. John would be dead in 10 minutes. More officers arrived on the scene in another squad car, and Cullen helped carry John's body to the car's back seat. John was barely conscious. The officers asked him some basic questions, and he silently nodded his head in response. Cullen told the officers to take John to Roosevelt Hospital, 13 blocks away. "Radio it in," he said, "but don't say that you have John Lennon in the back seat. The place will be a zoo by the time you get there." Minutes later at Roosevelt, Dr. David Halloran, a 29-year-old general surgeon in his third year, held John Lennon's heart in his hands. The team of doctors and nurses had rushed John from the back of the squad car, cut away John's fur-lined leather jacket, his shirt, his jeans. John had lost so much blood that his pulse had faded. So Dr. Halloran opened John's chest, and he performed cardiac massage, hands directly on John Lennon's heart. Halloran continued to perform cardiac massage for 45 minutes, and John Lennon was declared dead that night. Back at the Dakota, officers Cullen and Spiro got Mark David Chapman into the back of their police cruiser and headed towards the station. Cullen tried to keep his anger at bay. He clenched his fists. He shook his head. He wanted to throw Chapman out the fucking window and into oncoming traffic. He attempted to refrain from saying something he would regret, but he just couldn't hold back. "Are you fucking crazy?" Cullen shouted back at Chapman from the front seat. "You just threw your whole life away." Chapman looked at Cullen through the rearview mirror. He blinked his eyes and responded calmly. "There is a little person and a big person inside of me, and tonight, the little person won." Cullen didn't know what the fuck Chapman was going on about, or what was going on in his head. Cullen just wanted to book the asshole and get him out of his face before he did something he really couldn't come back from. At the police station, other officers followed Cullen's lead. They couldn't believe what had happened. They couldn't understand. In their anger, their frustration, it all bubbled up and then burst through the surface in words that couldn't do their disbelief justice. "You know what you just did? Do you know who you just shot?" Chapman blinked some more. His eyes darted from one officer to another. He tried to play back what had happened in his mind, but the film strip was still broken. He couldn't go back. He could only go forward. "I am John Lennon," Chapman answered, "and I killed myself." Of course, Mark David Chapman was not John Lennon. Far from it. Mark David Chapman would never be John Lennon. He would never be that brave, never be that smart or that magnetic. He would never be that talented, and he would never capture the world with his songs or inspire a generation with his vision. Mark David Chapman only inspired contempt and disgust from his fellow man as he sat alone at the police station, waiting. Waiting in vain for a door to open that would never open. Waiting for a transfiguration that was clearly as fantastical as the sentences and paragraphs in a work of fiction. Mark David Chapman was not John Lennon. He did not become Holden Caulfield. He remained unchanged. But the rest of the world would never be the same again. Where once there was hope, now there was despair. And where once there was beautiful music, now there was just blood on the tracks.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening to Blood on the Tracks. If you like what you hear, be sure to find and follow Blood on the Tracks on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. On this season 2 of Blood on the Tracks, we'll be releasing 10 episodes on the incredible life of John Lennon, with a new episode every Thursday. You can also binge all 10 episodes of season 1 on the insane story of the notorious record producer Phil Spector. Right now, it's available wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Blood on the Tracks was written by Zeth Lundy and hosted and executive produced by me, Jake Brennan. Also executive produced by Brady Sadler. Story and copy editing by Pat Healy.
This episode was mixed by Colin Fleming. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. This episode featured Alan Adams as Mark David Chapman. Blood on the Tracks is produced by Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the Blood on the Tracks series page. If you want to chat about this show or hear more about the other shows we're making at Double Elvis, tap in on Instagram at Double Elvis, on Twitter at Double Elvis FM, and now on Twitch, where we're streaming 3 days a week at twitch.tv/Double Elvis Podcasts. And finally, be sure to check out Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I also host. Disgraceland is available only on the free Amazon Music app. To hear tons of insane stories about your favorite musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly, go to amazon.com/Disgraceland, or if you have an Echo device, just say, Alexa, play the Disgraceland podcast. Rock and roll.
That's crazy. Oh, dang it.